Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Good evening and welcome to this evening's episode, our first post-election episode of the Mary Trump Show. I am beyond honored and grateful and many other things as my guest, the extraordinary Joy Reid. Joy, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, Mary, thank you for having me. This is exciting. This is fun.
It's fun because you get free reign here. I get to hear whatever you want to say, no holds barred. And honestly, you were one of the first people I thought of when finding a guest for the first episode after Tuesday, and also known as the most important election of our lifetime.
Yeah.
Although that's now 2024. So
yeah.
So I just wanted, before we broaden the conversation to other things, I just wanted to check in and get your take on the lead up to the election and how you've been feeling since at least we're still waiting for results, but you know, we have a fair idea about where things stand.
Yeah. I mean, well, first of all, thanks again for having me on, Mary. You're one of the most fearless people that's out there, and I love you, and I love everything you say. I agree with not just because I agree with everything you say, but I just love the fact that you have the cojones to say the things, you know, so I appreciate you. And so I think in the election, it proved a couple of things, right? It first of all proved that the pundit class and the media have learned absolutely nothing from when your uncle, who I cannot believe that you're even related to. I know you came from the good dad, the good Trump. Your dad was cool from the book that I've read about the family. So you come from the good wing of the family. But since, you know, Donald Trump ran for president, I feel like the media learned absolutely nothing, because I feel like collectively the media made a lot of the same exact mistakes that they made then. And that, quite frankly, they made when George W. Bush, was running for re-election, and after having started a war that was an unnecessary war, they learned nothing from that era either. And that is that Republican narratives dominate the so-called liberal media. There is no liberal media. Let's just be clear. There isn't a liberal media. There are a few liberals like myself who are on TV and that are on radio and that do podcasts, but there's no liberal media, quote unquote. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that the media collectively made, not calling out any individual media, just in general, was relying on these polling averages, which the Republican Party is really good at gamesmanship, not so good at governing, really good at gamesmanship. And they gamed these polling averages by dumping tons of these crappy, small Republican-leaning polls with no backup to the data. They dumped them into 538. They dumped them into Real Clear Politics, which even the New York Times admitted in 2020 was now basically a pro-Trump outfit. Yep. And the media just took all that at face value and started yelling, red wave, red wave, red wave. You can go across the board from the New York Times to Axios to on down. Everyone was saying the red wave is coming. Politico, red wave is coming. Red wave is coming. CNN, red wave is coming. Everyone, red wave is coming. And that set up an expectation that was not just false, it was dangerous. We are so lucky that this election, which went exactly as, you know, the real polling numbers, taking away the crap polls, said it was going to go, the way it logically went after you rip abortion rights away from half the country. You know, you don't even have to know politics that well to understand what women were going to do after you did that to women, right? And so it went the way it was supposed to. We're just lucky there wasn't violence, and that we're still, it's not over yet because we're still counting a couple of states as of this taping, because you set up MAGA, which we know now is willing to try to violently overthrow the government. We know now is tied up with the 3%ers and the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. And you set those people up to, and basically guaranteed them a red wave, Really? Well, that doesn't seem very responsible. So I think that was the biggest takeaway.
Yeah. And Joy, I want to get into specifically what you were just talking about in terms of framing expectations and polling. But before that, I want to point out for those who may not know this, it is kind of astonishing, too, the number of so-called election deniers, which we can also call anti-democratic, anti-American people running for office, have conceded. So how do we make sense of that? But I'll take it, because that kind of suddenly responsible behavior will help diffuse any tendency on the right to commit acts of violence to make a point. But as you said, from the beginning, and we're talking months out, the expectation was always, conventional wisdom says, that of course the party out of power is going to gain a lot of seats. That's historically what happens. And this has driven me crazy for years now. And I know that you have pointed this out as well. The media continue, generally speaking, to treat the Biden administration as if it's a normal administration that took over from another normal administration. And these are normal times. So just kind of setting up the expectation that Republicans would win big was denying the truth that we are living in very serious, unusual times in modern American history. But then we also had this. Okay, so Republicans, of course, are going to win hugely. Democrats start closing, largely because of the Dobbs decision. And then the Democrats have a slight lead. And then, of course, inflation and gas prices, and the Republicans start taking over again. And suddenly it's a disaster for Democrats, even though they weren't ever supposed to win in the first place.
Right.
So it's very difficult to live in these times where it always seems, no matter what, like the media is pulling for the other side. You know, they set up this, it's like heads I win, tails you lose, no matter what you do. So do you often feel like Sisyphus pushing the rock?
Often or always?
Always.
You know, it's amazing because yes, I feel like, you know, and Jay Rosen at NYU has done a lot of really good work on this. And there's a lot of good research to back it up, that there's a tendency in media to try to placate Republicans as much as possible to convince them that you're neutral, right? That the way to seem neutral is to take whatever Republicans say at face value and to take whatever Democrats say with incredible doubt. And to always try to, you know, how many times is the New York Times going to go to a diner in the Midwest and talk to white voters about their economic anxiety? They're in a diner. They obviously have enough money to eat out. Okay. They ain't got that much anxiety. Okay. Clearly, they got a little extra coin.
Yeah.
They ain't home. Yeah. They're eating out in a diner, you know? And the New York Times, I mean, how many times are we going to have them wistfully looking out the window saying, I don't feel seen? You're seen by the New York Times. You're being seen right then and there by the so-called liberal media. They see you, buddy. You're in the diner. And there's a reporter talking to you.
Incredible.
You're seen.
And you're on the front page.
You're on the front page, looking wistfully out into the distance, going, I just wish Trump could be president forever. Okay, they see you, man. They oversee you, okay? You know who they never go out and talk to? Black people. They don't ever talk to us. They ain't coming to our diners, okay? Because if they did, they would tell you, we're all voting for the Democrats. That's like, other than like 10% of us, we're going to vote for the Democrats. That is how we vote, okay? So it's like, I don't know. I feel like the media, there's a theory about it. And I wrote a little bit about it in one of the books I wrote that talks about the fact that the media used to be really bad on matters of race, right? So if you go back to the early 20th century, the media used to actually report on lynchings, even the New York Times. And they would report on them in advance. They would report on them in a way that basically made the lynching seem justified. And Black journalists like Ida B. Wells was demanding that they stop doing that. And the NAACP demanded that the media, especially the Northern media, I mean, the Southern media would celebrate lynchings, but so did the New York Times. There's a famous story that recently was published about the Times kind of celebrating the lynching of a bunch of Italian guys, because, you know, Italians were the second most lynched group because they weren't considered white. Right. Back in the early 20th century. And then something happened around the 1950s and 60s. The media, with television coming online, they would go down into the South and they would interview Southerners and they would be openly racist. They would use the N-word. They would say Blacks want to be segregated. They would say all kind of crazy racist things on TV because they were trying to make their case. And the media suddenly said, you know what? There are good guys and bad guys here. This isn't a neutral story. We need to report on the civil rights movement as it's the heroic movement and the other side are the bad guys. That created this whole trajectory of this myth that the media is liberal, that the media is against white people, the media is against Southerners, the media is against the Southern way of life. And that really was ingrained until a guy named Roger Ailes figured out how to weaponize it and monetize it. And then we got Rupert Murdoch, Fox News, that whole thing. So we have this whole kind of sentiment that's set into the media that there's a bias against conservatives, which are now Republicans, which used to be Democrats were the conservatives. Now it's Republicans. And that perception of bias has seeped into, I think, almost every newsroom where they're like, we got to find ways to make the Republicans feel like we see them, like we don't hate them. And so we're just going to take whatever narratives they put out and we're going to at least give voice to them. We're going to take them at face value. And in a case like this, where you're dealing with an almost 1930s level of fascist behavior by one party, which, to be fair, the Democrats used to do too back in the, you know, early 1900s. It was the Democrats that were like this. Mm-hmm. But now that it's the Republicans, it's like no one wants to admit it. Like no one wants to go there. But we there, man, because they literally stormed the freaking Capitol.
And that wasn't on the ballot. Before we started, You mentioned that, unlike most everybody else, which as it turns out, except for me, because I was on the same page with you, you were optimistic going in to Tuesday. And quite honestly, I was so optimistic that I'm a little disappointed, which is immature. And it's all very, very good. Yeah. And it's actually looking even better.
Yeah.
But the part of the reason it's still close is because of so many things that weren't on the ballot. But in addition to the institutional disadvantages Democrats always find themselves under, you know, in addition to the horrible polls and the mainstream media's failures to frame this election properly, what wasn't explicitly on the polls, yes, in the voters' minds, thankfully, but what wasn't explicitly on the polls, January 6th, the big lie, the fact that the head of the Republican Party is still roaming free despite the fact that he stole thousands of documents from the U.S. government, and God knows what he did with the top secret, highly sensitive documents that we know he stole.
Right.
Right. And there's this failure also to help people understand that we are one of the reasons the Democrats continue to struggle is because the underlying problems have never been addressed. The underlying problem is that America is a racist country. And when you fail to face that head on, you get into a situation where, people think that inflation and high gas prices are the most important thing, democracy farther down on the list. So on the one hand, when journalists tell you that, they're telling you that they failed miserably at their job because, you know, they're letting voters think that inflation and high gas prices are more important than democracy. But you're also leading to a situation in which, you know, 72% of white women in Georgia voted for Brian Kemp. So it's so we're dealing with so many different complex issues, and yet it still seems like it's pretty simple. We're dealing with the same shit that has been going on in my entire lifetime, and that has worsened considerably because of things like Shelby County versus Holder, which was the beginning of the unraveling of the voting rights. I feel like I'm rambling, but sorry, right. Because it's like, it just, it seems like it's so simple. And yet, given the way you set up the problems with the media, it feels like an intractable problem, because it's been framed as a political problem.
And framed as a game. Like, I think the sportsification of politics has been one of the most destructive things that we've seen ever, because it's turned into a game of, probabilities of who's going to win, and you know, putting those probabilities out before an election, I actually think is absolutely wrong. Like, we shouldn't even be airing polls 30 days out from an election, because it's suppressive, right? Yep. To tell people, oh, don't worry about it, Republicans are going to win. So then why should Democrats come out at all? Maybe should just stay home. If you watch a lot of newscasts, you as a Democrat, Democrats I talked to were so pre-demoralized. And when I would tell them, no, I think Democrats are going to hold the Senate, they would be in absolute shock. Everyone I told before the election, you know, I even would say it on my team meetings. You know, my team had to hear this from me every morning at 11 o'clock. I'm like, no, Democrats are going to hold the Senate and the House is a toss up. I told lots of people that, and they all were completely shocked. I had Democrats who work in the business, who are in the business of working in politics, already pre-demoralized that they were going to lose every race. And I'm like, based on what? What data are you using? The polling averages. They're using the same bad data that the Republicans had gained. And you make a point that I think is so important, and it's one of the reasons we can't seem to fix this, is no one wants to tell 60, 62, 65% of the country a truth that's uncomfortable. It makes a lot of reporters uncomfortable to talk about it. And there's not a critical mass of people of color in media like myself who are willing to say these uncomfortable things, right? I mean, I've taught classes. I used to teach at Syracuse, and my classes would be all white. There would be basically like four. I usually had like a few kids who were matriculated from China, because Syracuse had a lot of Chinese students. Mm-hmm. And I would have maybe one Black kid, maybe one Asian American kid, but it was mostly white kids. And I was as blunt as I'm being with you right now about race. I mean, I would open my class talking about lynching. And those kids survived this conversation with this Black lady talking about race. It will not break white people to talk about race, but the media and some of our governors, thinking Ron DeSantis, they act like people will break, they'll shatter if you present them with factual information about race. But here's the problem with that. The whole country was a slave colony. And you can't undo a slave colony without breaking a few dishes, without a few things getting uncomfortable. You can't have a country that is on purpose racially diverse because you keep trying to replace the slaves with other brown people who will work for almost nothing. So then we got to get the brown people to work for nothing. Okay, now they're tired of it. You know, oh no, we forgot. We got the Chinese to build the railroads for almost nothing. Okay, they didn't want to do that anymore. Now they wanted to have a decent living. Let's go get the Puerto Ricans. We'll just grab their whole island and make them be here because we want their labor for free. You can't keep adding. Then we're like, we'll get the Italians. We really don't think they're white, but we'll just pretend they're white when it's convenient demographically, right? Like it's we keep doing this and having these really fundamental racial conflicts. Like, you think about the previous versions of the insurrection we had in January 2021. It was in places like Wilmington, North Carolina. It was in places like Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was in throughout this country. We keep having insurrections, and they're all about the same thing. A certain percentage of white Americans not being willing to share power with Black people. And that's what the other insurrection in January 2021 was about, too. The anger and rage that mostly people of color, mainly Black people, voted for Joe Biden. And that is fundamentally seen as illegitimate by a certain percentage of white Americans. The end. They want their candidate to win. And also they want to always win. And they want to be guaranteed they will always win. And that's it. And it's not more complicated than that. That's what the insurrection was about. And I'm sorry to break it to folks, but that was it.
Yeah, and the fact that this is news to many people is just a sign of how miserably we fail at educating people, because it's always going to happen if the two things that always seem to occur when something bad happens. We're told that we can't look back. We have to look forward. Like, we're just so weak and pathetic. And, you know, this is one thing that I'll give Donald credit for. It's like he suddenly made it like really cool and a sign of maturity never to take responsibility for your mistakes.
I, like, I did like, nothing wrong.
I didn't grow up with that particular lesson. You know, and then, of course, the other thing is that white people are such precious snowflakes that teaching them the truth about our country's history will mortally wound them somehow. And to me, the great irony there is by choosing to remain ignorant, then you actually do start to bear responsibility for the perpetuation of these incredibly unfair, racist systems that are still in place. So it, like, I figure like if we could figure out how to message that, you know, because if you go in and knowing people are going to all of a sudden get, you know, the white people, are you racist? No, I'm not racist. Like, they immediately get defensive. It's like, if you grew up in the 70s or 80s in America as a white person, you're racist. Sorry, buddy. So anyway, I think another way to deal with this issue head on is to increase the diversity of voices from whom we get our information. And in the process, sort of right the wrong of what is journalistic neutrality, right? Mm-hmm. So we're told that Fox is fine, but black journalists are incapable of neutrality in mm-hmm. because they're black or something.
Right.
So it seems like there's, well, not seems like, there has been this very disturbing trend starting, I'm sure starting before this, but you know, from Melissa Harris Perry, through Lena Maxwell, and now most recently Tiffany Cross, I'm sure many others in between. And I know Jason Johnson is in the crosshairs. You've been in the crosshairs for a very, very long time. And it doesn't seem like the right response is to diminish the number of voices, but to increase them. So there is not just representation demographically, but overrepresentation of voices that have been missing from the conversation for far too long.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I mean, if you think about it, we live in a world where Tucker Carlson can literally spew white nationalism every night on a major, on the largest, on the most prolific cable network of all. Like, he can do that with no consequences. He can attack me, he can attack Tiffany, he can attack Jason, he can go in on Ellie Mistal. He can do that all day long, and there's no consequences for him, period, other than he has no advertisers, but it doesn't matter. Fox doesn't require him to make money on his show. They just want him to keep talking. They actually gave him a second show. I think he has a streaming show too. He can literally you know, put Kanye West on for an hour knowing he's not all there, you know. I'd like to see him on his meds before him getting interviewed again, but he can exploit him for an hour to get, and then edit it weirdly to take out the openly anti-Semitic stuff, because I guess that's Tucker's own job to do that bit, you know, and that's fine, apparently, right? You want to keep all that for himself, you know, when he and Orban are on together, maybe they can talk about the, you know, the Jewish folks themselves.
And he wanted Kanye to keep that Adidas sponsorship.
Yeah, so that he could have a reason to bring it back on, right? Yeah. So he can do that, and that's fine. But for Black journalists, if we respond to it, I mean, Megyn Kelly, who, you know, she got let go, you know, from her contract because of racism, like literally because of racism, literally. And yet she's free to go off and take her $69 million and not, for whatever reason, still want to say more things. And that, whatever, you know, it's fine. She can do that. She has a right to say whatever she wants to say. But it's far riskier. You know, Ellie Mistal did a post thread about this, that it's much riskier for a person who is Black or brown to do the same thing. It's much riskier for Black folks to talk about race in a forthright way, or to even defend themselves against racist attacks in a forthright way. You're taking a far bigger risk if you're doing that as Black, doing that in Black skin, if you know. And so it's a high wire act that I think white commentators don't have to ever face or deal with or confront, because it's just riskier, you know, it just is. And that's unfortunate, because it shouldn't be riskier. And we need more voices who are willing to speak for it, Rathi, about race, because unfortunately the way that the U.S. education system works is that we haven't really taught a lot of white folks. Not everybody's Tim Wise. You know, Tim Wise, like the wokest white guy ever, right? He knows the history. He fought David Duke as a young man, fought his political career and fought his political rise. So he gets it. But there aren't that many people who really do. Dave Zirin, there are a few. But for by and large, white Americans are shielded from the racial history of this country in a way Black people are not. We grow up knowing exactly what America is. And that doesn't mean we love America any less, but we just know what we're dealing with. Right. We know what we're dealing with. We understand that racism is here in big ways and in small, in, you know, somebody asking, what's your name? When you call to get a job and you say Tamika and they don't call you back. We know what that is. When you see an apartment listing open and you show up to look at the apartment and all of a sudden it's not available. We know that still happens even in New York, not just in the South, right?
I think I was related to somebody who did something
put
like
C for colored on
something like that.
Something like that.
Thanks, you know, Grandpa.
We know what that is, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like we journalists of color are just built different. We're built to say these things, and we have no problem saying it. We don't feel discomfort saying it because we grew up knowing it's true, and people have trouble hearing it. And get really uncomfortable hearing it. You know, we're not uncomfortable saying we understand that Clarence Thomas has no interest in us as Black people. We know he has no interest. We know he's not waking up at night thinking about Black folks. We get it. But if we say it, it's more risky for us to even say it about him, and he's Black. So, you know, I think that the challenge for the media is we need all the diversity we can get, not just people who are Black, but people who are willing to say the Black things forthrightly and to say them without fear, because it's risky for us to do it. That we should, but somebody's got to do it.
Somebody's got to do it, and that also connects up with how the Democratic Party, I think, seriously needs to look in the mirror long and hard. And running up to this election, I have a show on Tuesdays called The Strategy Session, and we focused on. It wasn't about policy. It was purely about how what the Democrats can do to increase their chances of winning, et cetera. So I always held my punches when it came to things I maybe disagreed with that the Biden administration or Democrats in general were doing. Well, the gloves have to be off now because we did do extraordinarily well yesterday. We need to seize that momentum and run with it and take the first, because the, you know, as you know, the 2024 presidential election started yesterday. Makes me want to go to an island for a couple of years, but anyway,
take me with you.
I will if it ever becomes an option. So that's at least a year, I think, to kind of confront the Democrats very openly with what I believe are serious mistakes and limitations. The fact that Democrats are often comfortable, or, you know, Democratic leadership is often comfortable telling people, whether it's Blacks or immigrants or transgender people or people in the whole LGBTQ plus community, that we just need to defer your rights for another election cycle because it's too dangerous. That shit's got to stop, because that is, forget about the fact, not forget about the fact, but let's leave aside for a moment the fact that it's never very smart to disrespect your entire base. You know, I wish the Democrats treated their base with the same deference that the right treats its base. And of course, the difference being that the right's base is a bunch of fascist, white supremacist, misogynistic, racist, anti-Semitic, horrible people. So, you know, so yes, so let's not diss the base. But also, I just think it's terrible strategy anyway. I mean, it's wrong. It's, as a human being, it's wrong. But what do we do to make that argument compelling enough for the Democrats to say, you know what? It is not right that the votes of Black Americans are suppressed all the time. And I love, you know, when they say 2020 was the freest and fairest election, I'm like, yeah, tell that to the tens of millions of Black Americans who were stricken off the voter rolls and had no recourse, right? Mm-hmm. it's not okay that trans women are murdered at far greater rates. It's not okay to torture children of people trying to come into this country simply because it's not okay for either gay children or children with gay parents to be made to feel like second class citizens. What do you attribute that reluctance to? Because I honestly think it is the biggest obstacle in the Democrats' ability to have the kinds of majorities it actually should have.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, if you think about who is the Democratic base, right? Historically, the Democratic base actually used to be white working class people when the Democrats were the conservative party, mm-hmm. and it was Southerners, Southern white working class folks. That all shifted, you know, you get to FDR and Black voters started to be interested in voting for Democrats because of the New Deal, even though they were locked out of a lot of it by FDR, who had his own racism problems, but he also was being pragmatic. He knew he needed Southern votes to get things through Congress, even though they had a supermajority of like 67 votes. But Black folks started voting for Democrats, and Truman comes in and he opens up the military. More Blacks go in, you know, and, you know, by the time Eisenhower comes along, like, it's kind of a tug of war between Democrats and Republicans. And Democrats are largely winning that tug of war. By the time Kennedy comes along, Black folks are Democrats. When Barry Goldwater, you know, that whole wing of the party drives Democrats, but Black folks just out of the party, and then Nixon finishes the job, right? So then you have the party switch places and switch bases. So Black folks are the Democrats' strongest base. Black women vote like 96% Democratic. Black men, even on their worst day, vote 88 to 90% Democratic. Don't believe the hype. Black men vote more Democratic than the next largest group, which is Jewish Americans, who vote about 83% Democratic. Don't believe that hype either. They're not switching to Republicans. They've been Democrats since World War II. And then you go down to about 2/3 of Hispanics, and it's gotten to be about 2/3 to 3/4 of Asian Americans when they bother to poll Asian Americans, which is another issue of polling. So the Democratic Party is the racially polyglot party. It's also the party of both religiously liberal people and irreligious people, people who are not affiliated with a religion. It's also the party of young people. If we go back to white voters for a second, we were talking about that earlier. In this election, we had a very big shift in about three different groups of white voters toward the Democratic Party. White voters under 30 voted substantially in favor of Democrats. That normally doesn't happen. Ask Ron Brownstein, go look at all of his data. Even in a pretty good year for Democrats, you're lucky if you can get half of white voters under 30 typically to vote Democratic. Mostly all white voters are about 60-40 Republican. But white voters in this election went about 55% for Democrats. That's historic. Young people saved this country. It was millennials and Gen Zers who dragged this election toward the Democrats. They're also the most exorcised about Roe. White voters who don't go to church went about 60-40 for Democrats, another major group. White women who are unmarried went substantially for Democrats, unmarried white women.
That's why Jesse Waters wants all of us to get married and settle down.
Correct. So these are the groups of people who would be considered woke. What does woke means? It means they're empathetic. That's all woke means. Just stay up, know what's happening to other people and give a damn, right? So that's why they fight wokeness so hard, because young people tend to be more empathetic. Ironically, irreligious people tend to be more empathetic than highly religious people, which is the high irony. As a Christian, somebody who grew up in the church, I found it sad and ironic, right? And people who are untethered in a marriage tend to be more independent, independent women. So one thing Democrats could do is maximize the votes of those people. If you want white voters so bad, like people like Tim Ryan, who were out there trying to run as a pretend MAGA and sucking up to MAGA voters, he got 9% of Republican votes. So ignoring the Black vote didn't help him win. It helped him lose. Sherrod Brown doesn't do that. Sherrod Brown doesn't run ads saying Donald Trump was right about .. China and I voted against Obama and the .. trade bill. He runs as a Democrat and he wins all the time in Ohio. So it's not unwinnable. And then looking at the party did not invest, for instance, in Gary Chambers in Louisiana. Most Black Americans still live in the South.
Yep.
The South should be as competitive as Michigan. Michigan has about 12% African Americans. You can regularly not just elect a Democrat in Michigan. You can get Big Gretch reelected and take over the whole House, State House, and Senate.
That's right. How,
and Black voters drive that vote in Michigan. And they're only 12% of the population. So how come Mississippi, which has 33% African Americans in their population, can't elect but one Black congressman? Yes, gerrymandering, but statewide? Because nobody turns out to vote. Black folks don't turn out to vote there. They don't turn out to vote in Louisiana. There are 949,000 approximately registered Black Democrats in Louisiana. Kennedy, who just got reelected, the guy who fakes being Foghorn Leghorn, even though he's a Rhodes Scholar.
Oxford.
He got reelected with 800 and something thousand votes, 100,000 votes fewer than the number of Black Democrats registered in the state. You know how many of them turned out? What, maybe 10, 20% for a Black candidate? Go to Florida. I was on the phone.
And a good candidate.
An excellent candidate. Go to Florida. Val Demings, brilliant woman, very popular. Turnout anemic. Yes, Miami-Dade went Republican because it's Cuban-American dominated. Most of the Blacks have moved out of Miami-Dade and moved to Broward. Broward is the Black county. You know what the turnout was in Broward? Anemic. Terrible. Jacksonville, very Black. Low turnout. Orange County, her county. Low turnout. You see where I'm going here? Kentucky, another great Black candidate.
I'm getting a sense of the trend.
You know, Charles Booker, who's a fantastic candidate. Fantastic. Nobody even likes Rand Paul in Kentucky. Start with that. They can't stand neither of their senators. He still got reelected. Was the Black turnout high? No. Did the Democratic Party in Kentucky try to turn it out? No. Did the Democratic Party in Florida try to turn out the Black vote? No. Did the Democratic Party in North Carolina try to help Sherry Beasley, a statewide elected official 5 minutes ago because she was the Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice. She was viable. She barely lost. What did the Democratic Party in North Carolina do for her? Not a whole hell of a lot. So you see where I'm going? The party doesn't, either they don't want these candidates. It's like they want just enough Black voters to come out to keep whoever's already in office in office. But because Louisiana got a Democratic governor.
That's right.
Kentucky got a Democratic governor.
That's right.
You can elect a Democrat statewide in Florida because the lady who is agriculture commissioner is a female Democrat.
That's right.
So it's like Democrats can get elected in these southern states. And then here's the most egregious one of all, Mary, Mandela Barnes.
Yeah.
You know, the most successful combination to elect a governor in this country for Democrats is a white gubernatorial candidate and a black lieutenant governor. Worked in New Jersey, worked in Wisconsin. Okay, follow me. He was the lieutenant governor, Mandela Barnes. How could a former sitting lieutenant governor not beat Ron Johnson, who's an insurrectionist? You know why? Did the party have a campaign that compelled Wisconsin Black voters to get out in crazy numbers for this basically statewide Barack Obama? No.
Troy, I completely agree with everything about it. I find it maddening, absolutely maddening. And you know what? It isn't simply that the Democratic candidates are extraordinary human beings. Stacey Abrams.
Oh, Sherry my God. Beasley, don't start
I can't.
Don't
I can't. I can't. I know. It's like
fall that, out.
She was,
who talk about deserving. This she lady was, built the Black turnout machine in that state. She registered. That state is 95% registered to vote because of her.
That's right. And Kemp stole the election from her last time because.
Come on.
Well, you know.
Come on.
Anyway, so that's even more painful because Stacey Abrams has done so much.
Hero.
Beyond just running and being amazing. Val Demings, extraordinary. Mandela, all these people you mentioned, Beto O'Rourke.
Come on.
And
come on now.
But it's also that the people they're running against
Ooh.
Are just the worst fucking people. I mean, issues with Tim Ryan, absolutely. But J.D. Vance.
Come on now. Right? That's embarrassing.
And it's sort of like this trend that didn't start with him, but it became glaringly obvious with Brett Kavanaugh. They could have nominated somebody who was just as horrible in terms of how he was going to vote, but he could have at least presented as a decent human being who hadn't sexually assaulted people and wasn't a thug. you know, but no, they have to shove it down our throats. The only caveat, I think, with Mandela Barnes, this is my opinion, I don't necessarily think in Wisconsin having Bernie Sanders be your surrogate was necessarily the best way to go, because it's Wisconsin.
And he didn't take PAC money. It's like, baby, take the PAC money. That's okay, right. You need money to win an election. Sherry Beasley ran out of money at the end. Didn't get an Obama visit to do GOTV. Yeah, you need to do political things to win. Don't say, oh, that's too political. I don't want the former president to come out. You know, take his visit. And if you're Mandela Barnes, take the money, man. Having the principles and having Bernie come out, that's not going to get you to win.
No, no. And to lose against Johnson, who is a Russian asset, for God's sakes, it's just unspeakably bad. And you're right. Look, I don't want Democrats to fight like Republicans. I don't want us cheating, lying, and stealing, and engaging in ad hominem attacks and threatening people at all. However, we do need to put the brass knuckles on. If they're doing it, and it's not cheating, lying, and stealing, we should do it. Take the money.
Take the money. You know? And the thing is, you have to build these state parties. I'm going to give Jamie Harrison credit. He put $90 million DNC money on the ground because he knows what it feels like to run in a tough state. He ran in South Carolina, lost to another person nobody likes, Lindsey Graham. I don't even know anybody in Lindsey Graham in South Carolina that actually likes Lindsey Graham. They just keep voting for him. He's a Republican. And it's very hard to get Southern white voters to vote for any Democrat. Although, again, they sometimes do. Because, again, North Carolina's got a Democratic governor. Louisiana's got a Democratic governor. On and on and on. I mean, Chris Jones. I forgot to mention Chris Jones running in Arkansas against Huckabee Sanders.
And he was a brilliant candidate.
He's a rocket scientist, literally.
Literally. And she's vile. She's just vile.
She just lied for a living for Trump. So it's like, it's frustrating because I think these state Democratic parties didn't listen to Howard Dean. Howard Dean was absolutely right about the 50-state strategy. And the consultant class that runs the Democratic Party refuses to let go of the reins and fund these state parties and populate them. Gary Chambers should become the new head of the Louisiana Democratic Party. Charles Booker should become the new head of the Kentucky Democratic Party. Yes. Val Demings should get a cabinet position or become the new head of the because people who have the balls to run in these unlikely states, and Florida is also an unlikely state, it's a red state, they are the people who know what it feels like on the ground. Stop restraining them with all these consultants around them who don't unleash them. Gary Chambers ran a great campaign because it was uninhibited. Yep. He didn't have any consultants, so he just did his thing. He burned a cross to show people about racism. Like, he spoke in a way people could understand. Charles Booker, same thing. These were brilliant candidacies. Sherry Beasley, too cautious. The candidacy was too cautious.
Yeah.
But the consultants made her do that. And so it's like, let these consultants back away. Let these brilliant candidates loose. Mandela Barnes ran away from being a progressive, tried to run back to being a progressive at the end. Figure out who you are and what your message is and just be strong in it. And you've got to get your base out. Republicans fear their base for good reason, because a lot of them have guns and they've got a lot of death threats to their own side. Yep. Like, a lot of Congress people are terrified of, literally terrified of their base. They're like, these people might kill me and my family. So they're afraid of their base. Democrats seem to hate their base or just sort of have disdain for them. They just disdain.
Yeah, and it doesn't make any sense. Like, we saw in Pennsylvania the degree to which being authentically yourself as a candidate mattered. I mean, Fetterman beat Connor Lamb because he ran as John Fetterman.
That's right.
Not as some candidate who was cooked up in a laboratory somewhere that we thought was going to appeal to everybody. And, you know, it's interesting, in you're going through all of this, I was guilty, again, because I set myself up for disappointment because I was so optimistic about this election, even though we're doing great. So, you know, don't listen to my my disappointment. But, you know, thinking, I've always believed that Democrats should fight for every single race from dog catcher on up.
Yes.
Right. But, you know, do we focus on things that are more gettable, like in a, not Ohio, like a Pennsylvania or a Wisconsin, then a Florida or an Ohio? And that's just a self-fulfilling prophecy, because I'm thinking, well, you know, I guess Florida is just a solidly red state. Well, it will be if we continue to fail to fight properly.
Yes.
And we can't keep doing that. And we do need to get to the bottom of what is going on. with the Democratic Party's just abject failure to understand, motivate, and honor the people who make it possible for them to be in positions of power.
100%.
It's quite something.
And Texas is a really good example. Beto O'Rourke is a decent, good man who had who deserved to win because he's the better man, right, than Abbott. But in the state of Texas, it's the most voter suppressed state in the country other than Wisconsin. But it is an extremely voter suppressed state because it's an apartheid state. It's a state run by white men, almost unique, almost entirely, but that the population is already majority Latino. And it's and Latino, the Latino demographic is America's youngest demographic. As it comes online, we're talking about what, like 18,000 a minute or something to come online as 18-year-olds or something. I'm probably overdoing the numbers, but you know, millions of Latinos become 18 like every week. You know, they keep coming. And if they voted at scale, they're 15% of the population. If Latinos voted at scale, they are 2/3 Democrats. Republicans would never be able to win another election, let alone in Texas, Arizona, and Nevada, any place where they have substantial numbers, but they don't vote at scale. Who in the party? Cortez Masto is a really good a really good version of this. So Nevada has a substantial Hispanic population. It's very much concentrated in those Las Vegas area unions. Maria Teresa Kumar, who we both know, who's fabulous, and both a Latino, has been trying to do this work. You know, the party, the state parties, and that party actually is quite a quality party. Harry Reid built a hell of a party in Nevada. But there's at the national scale, there's a reluctance to have Cortez Masto lean into being Latina. She's the only Latina senator. She's the only one there is. And so having her lean into that and activate her community, that's not dissing white working class voters who Democrats are obsessed with. White working class voters are Republicans. They're Republicans now. Let it go. Start leaning into getting, get your Black voters to vote, get your Latinos, get your Asian Americans, get them excited with a message that they can understand. There was in language attacks to try to pull Asian Americans. Republicans are on Chinese speak, Chinese language radio, you know, in their ears. They're on Cuban radio saying all the Democrats are communists, all the Democrats are communists. They're on Haitian radio in Miami, in their ear. Are Democrats there? No. Democrats are seeding this ground. And the future of this country is multiracial. And you want white voters, Democrats, you want white voters? They're there for you. They're young. They are the young white voters. They're the unmarried women. They're the people who don't go to church. Those people are your people. They voted for you this midterm in big numbers. They're the ones who are scared about Roe. Get those voters to vote for you. Young women, young unmarried women, young people, period, of all races, non-church people and liberal church people. I'm a church person. We got liberal church folks. Come get us.
Yes,
stop,
we do.
Stop pining for white working class Republicans. Because they're never coming back. It's like when you dated somebody and you're like, you know, I like my new person. You know, they pay the bills and they're so nice to me. But I really want my old beater husband back. I want my old beater boyfriend back. That's what Democrats are.
Right. We don't want them back. Like, why should we want them back? You know, before 2020, I would ask, like, what do we talk to these people? Like, no, ignore them. Jesus, anybody who votes for Donald Trump twice needs to be ignored forever.
They gone. It's like trying to interview Kanye. He gone, y'all.
Right?
He's gone now. Play his old music.
Leave
him alone.
Yeah, because there's
play late registration.
There are
on your
couple of songs that I actually am quite fond of.
Too.
I just pretend that they're by
no
somebody
one
else.
Should have all that power. I love it.
It's the Kanye who does
song.
It. That's right. But even if when the Democrats do pay attention, and you know, Maria, I'm glad you mentioned Maria Teresa Kumar. She's phenomenal. Photo Latina is phenomenal organization. But Democrats who don't understand how these things work, and yet should, when they do address the Hispanic voter, they treat Hispanics like it's a friggin' monolith. Like, how many different kinds of Latino / Hispanic voters are there in this country? You know, you can't just approach them all like they believe the same things or come from the same places or have the same ideas or the same concerns about things And you know, same thing with young voters. So I feel like I know we have to go soon, and yeah. I have enjoyed this so tremendously. I'm telling you, I've been looking forward to this for such a long time. And I mean, I've been watching you since AM Joy forever ago. So this is, and you know, the way your work has evolved as, because again, it's not like the challengers are new, but I think the numbers of people who are affected by them has changed dramatically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
it's tough out here.
It's tough out here, but I think knowing that is key. So before you go, I just wanted to, in addition just to thanking you for your extraordinary work, which is invaluable for so many reasons. I wanted to just check in with you and see, since we are in the 2024 election cycle already, what do you think are the key ways in which Democrats continue to increase their momentum? Because we do have it, mm-hmm. obviously, and get and grapple in real ways with the challenges that face. Like we didn't even talk about misogynoir or you know, the other kinds of sometimes subtle but always insidious ways in which people Democrats should be talking to get silenced or, you know, are somehow not factored in. Yeah. That was really poorly question.
No, I get it.
So sorry. But what are the shifts you'd like to see, and what are the pressure points that you think we need to be pressing on?
So I think one of the things that I'm going to quote Mr. Rogers, the great Mr. Rogers, look for the helpers, right?
Yeah.
Democrats need to start looking through their bench, because they actually do have a bit of a little bitty bench now. We're building a little bench. There are some really good messengers. Get them out there and make them do a lot of the talking. I think the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, is a fantastic messenger. Yep. He's gutsy. He's strong. Big Gretch. She is, to me, absolutely, the biggest story of these midterms, because she survived a kidnapping attempt.
Seriously.
Okay. And then swept, got back in, easily reelected, and swept the whole House and State House and Senate. She's a future leader, really smart. Look at Shapiro. This guy, he like did his own little version of Obama. Those little speeches he did at the end. I said, oh, I see the Obama in
that
you, my
was
friend.
Amazing. I the first one I heard, I wasn't watching.
Yeah.
And I thought it was Obama.
seriously, you had the sound down, because he was doing his Obama. Fetterman is so authentic. He done sent Oz back to New Jersey. That's a powerful man. He packed up, went home, you know. He's great. And also Wes Moore, who won the historic election in Maryland, my governor.
Yep.
Fabulous. Potential future president. And even some of the candidates who didn't win, don't let Beto go. Keep him. He's still a great messenger. Right. He's still got options. And then you got young people like Maxwell Frost,
that's
who
right.
won in Florida. Florida ain't all bad. Maxwell Frost won. There's some good news there. Find those people, make those your messengers. You know, AOC, probably your best messenger to Gen Z. My kids, they listen to her. If she puts something on her Instagram, they will believe it, and they will listen to her more than they listen to me. Like, they listen to her. She is a great messenger. Let her target young people. Let the other members of the squad target young people. Use those really strong voices and let them do your messaging, because y'all ain't good at it on the national level. It's not what your strength is. And then the second piece is, use these former Republicans, because if Republicans are good at nothing else, it's messaging. And people like the Lincoln Project, Duty to Warn, these former Republicans, the Rick Wilsons of the world, their power hasn't been marshaled enough, because they're actually better at messaging than Democrats are, because they came from that really strong messaging machine on the other side. Now they're on our side, the pro-democracy side, and start letting them really push out your messaging. But it can't just be on Twitter. An ad they post on Twitter is not enough. Put some money behind some of those ads. Those ads would have been great to be running in places like Florida and Wisconsin, et cetera. So number one is messaging.
Can I ask you a quick question about that? Because I so agree with that. And it seems like Lincoln Project, et cetera, yes, doing great work. I support them. I've done shows with them and fundraisers and stuff, but it feels like they were kind of just put in their little place and not brought in to the fight.
Right.
And so always from the outside, and again,
that's
effective,
right.
But I think you're right. Bringing them inside,
that's right.
And collaborating would be much more effective, because
much
otherwise
effective.
It just seems like they're disgruntled anti-Trump people, as opposed to, from what I can tell, at least from the people I've spoken with and work with, are truly pro-democracy.
And those people might as touch. These guys are on the outside posting those videos, mostly on social. And that's fine. But put some money behind those kinds of ads. And I'm sure there are firms of color, because there's also a diversity problem inside the Democratic Party's consultant class. Mm-hmm. There are great firms of Black, brown-owned firms, LGBTQ firms. Make more diversity in terms of who's doing these ads. Stop letting these same old cronies do all these ads that don't work and that don't help. Find out who did the ads.
Uh-oh.
That's for you, right? Start getting effective people to do your messaging. That's number one. Number two, I would say, is start the messaging on 2024 now. Don't wait until next year, until he who shall remain nameless announces his campaign and he and DeSantis start destroying each other, which I'm actually here for. I'm actually here for that fight.
We're going to have lots of popcorn together.
We're going to enjoy it. Go ahead and dog walk each other. Put, you know, dog walk one another. I'm happy for it. I'm here for it. So start your messaging now, because the threats to democracy didn't end with this election and won't end with this election. Anti-democracy forces they don't get tired. Anti-women forces don't get tired. Don't think they're not coming for birth control. They are. Don't think they're not coming for your IUD ladies. All of you white ladies who still voted Republican, they're coming for you eventually too. The Handmaid's Tale don't end well for anybody in that movie, and you're in the movie too. So start your messaging now, and for God's sakes, put some money in these states, not just the swing states, every state, 50 state strategy, make Republicans spend money everywhere. It was worthwhile for Charles Booker to force Rand Paul to spend money in Kentucky and to build the basis of a new party there. It was worth it for Chambers to force Kennedy to worry a little bit and spend some money, and for him to travel around that state and begin to build the base. The turnout machine needs to be built, not now, not a year from now, not 6 weeks out from the election. Start building that turnout machine and that messaging today.
Absolutely. That was extraordinary. I'm actually going to like cut that and clip and just put it everywhere, because that is the plan. That is the game plan. And Joy, the work you do is so, as I said earlier, it's invaluable. I'm grateful to everything you're doing, and just you're speaking truth to power, pulling no punches. So everybody, Joy Reid, journalist, host of The Readout on MSNBC, which you should be watching every day. And it's just so awesome when we get more of you, when you guys are doing election results and stuff like that. So extraordinary human being, Joy Reid. Thank you so much for being
here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. Thank you for having me on.
I love you too. All right. Stay safe out there.
Okay. Peace.
Okay, as I mentioned, I've been feeling just a little bit despondent over the election results, because I don't know, maybe I have more faith in human nature than I should, and I really wanted the Democrats to win really big. But I feel so happy right now, because I just got to spend an entire hour with Joy Reid. So thank you to Joy. I admire what she does so much, and I assume a lot of you already watch her show. But for those who don't, definitely start, because, you know, she keeps us informed in a way that's real and that's necessary. And she has extremely great guests. So and of course, thank you to you, all of you, for joining us. It's always a pleasure. I so appreciate your comments and your support. And, you know, now that the election's over, we're going to start pivoting to the next one. And, you know, things are going to look a little different around here, because we don't have to hold back anymore. And we're not going to. So thank you again. Just don't forget to be here next Tuesday for the Mary Trump Show strategy sessions, although we might rename it now that we are in a new and in some cases more important election cycle with the Nerd Avengers. That's at 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on youtube.com/politicon. And of course, we'll be back next Thursday with our regular interview show with guest Ali Velshi. Really looking forward to that. That is at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, also at youtube.com/politicon. While you're on Politicon's YouTube channel, please subscribe to Politicon. It doesn't cost anything. Just the more people subscribing, the better. Leave a comment if you want. Like the episode. Click on that bell. That way you will be notified every time a new video drops. And I'm still not 100%, but hopefully on the mend. And once I'm totally back on my feet, I'm going to start making a lot more videos. So definitely click that bell so you can stay up to date with what's going on here at the Mary Trump Show. And speaking of the Mary Trump Show, we have rescheduled our live show in Los Angeles, which is at the Theater Dynasty Typewriter. It is going to be on Monday, January 19th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are going on sale, I think, this week. But I'll be tweeting about it, of course, at least as long as Elon Musk lets my tweets go out. That is going to be a blast. I'm really excited about it. I'll keep letting you know as we get closer. And that is it. Thank you so much for being here. Have a wonderful weekend. I will see you next Tuesday. In the meantime, please stay safe and be kind.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.